Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. How was it watching the Golden Globes from home like a normal person, like the rest
of us? Yeah, it was not that exciting. It was a lot more fun to be in a ballroom, but I like not having to get dressed up, and I like watching our coverage and live tweeting it. Let me tell you what happened this week. Sacha Baron Cohen won 2 Golden Globes, so that happened. As a result, Sacha and the folks behind his movie, Borat, subsequent film, which, as we say, did win 2 Golden Globes on Sunday night, they then joined The Wrap's Brian Welk for a discussion about the film this week.
So the very next day.
I know.
What fantastic luck.
We have incredible, you know, clairvoyance in our producing skills here. So we're going to have that roundtable for you. They're going to talk about the film, which they made just as the pandemic was getting started, how they cast their breakout star, Maria Bakalova, who's quite amazing in it, as Borat's daughter. And of course, that crazy scene with Rudy Giuliani.
Then I had the chance to speak with Steve Yockey, the showrunner and executive producer of the hit HBO Max series, The Flight Attendant. He wasn't as lucky at the Globes as Sasha, but he did talk to me about what it was like watching the show become a phenomenon and how season 2 is coming along. And I think maybe I got him to kind of give me a little something. Just saying. But first, Sharon, let's get some headlines. You know, there is some serious drama going on behind the scenes at ABC News, which can be described, as one person who you spoke with put it, as the pettiness of people battling over scraps. There is some serious tension between George Stephanopoulos, ABC's daytime man, and David Muir, who leads ABC World News Tonight. And it was former ABC News chief James Goldston who got caught in the crossfire. As you reported, Sharon, it turns out that Goldston, who abruptly left the gig in January, did so in part because of the way he handled the conflict between Muir and Stephanopoulos. Right. Sources told The Wrap that Muir was tapped to be the main guy in breaking news situations right after the inauguration, but no one told Stephanopoulos, and he didn't really take it that well. Disney executive chairman Bob Iger had to step in and make good with Stephanopoulos, who felt deceived about Muir's new role. In the end, the new Disney entertainment boss Peter Rice blamed Goldston for mismanaging the situation. Sharon, this was your big story of the week. What do you think we can expect going forward at ABC News?
Well, first of all, you did a really terrific job of summarizing a very complicated political infighting, knives out battle. I think we called it Game of Thrones, which it kind of is. One of my favorite things about the story is the anecdote of how let's say petty the jockeying got between George and David Muir It came down to basically George Stephanopoulos was called the chief anchor, or has been called the chief anchor at ABC News for years now. And he, as the chief anchor, got to be the guy who took over when there was breaking news or special events. And of course, during the last 4 years, there's been a lot of that, a lot of breaking into the news and jumping in to the anchor chair and leading the news, you know, effort over at ABC News. And he agreed to give up that title after the 2021 inauguration, because really David Muir's ratings, he's number one in the evening newscast on all the networks. He's definitely he's the big talent that ABC News has been counting on. They've definitely put that's the bet that they've made, but they want to keep George and they want to keep George Stephanopoulos happy, even though Good Morning America is, you know, it's leading in viewers, but it's not, it doesn't lead in the top demographic, and it's kind of struggled in the morning ratings. And George is older than David Muir. So the word is that my sources tell me is that when there would be breaking news, like this all came down to when the second impeachment happened after the January 6th riot, and impeachment is coming up as a big breaking news story. And George Stephanopoulos does not want to give up the chair. And so he gives up the chair like at 6:29, 1 minute before David Muir is supposed to
It's still spinning. It's like still spinning.
Yeah, exactly.
When he got up by the time we were sitting down.
this made David Muir crazy, felt totally disrespected. Apparently the two don't like or respect one another particularly. So when George gave up the title, he didn't think he was giving up those news responsibilities, so to speak, but he was. And one person I talked to said James Goldstein, who's British, has a British reticence about him to not, and may actually just not be as clear as you might want to be in a sticky situation like that. So, you know, news talent is talent, and they behave like talent.
And that's, I think, you know, for a network, you have a few faces, right? Like for someone like ABC, Jimmy Kimmel is kind of like the face of one half of the network, and your number one news guy is the face of another half. And so it's a big position. It's and I have to imagine a big ego thing, which when you're at that level, it's not to be, downplayed. It's a real factor. And I think, you know, to your point at the end there, that it seems like Goldstein had a hard time breaking the news, if you will, to Stephanopoulos that there was a bit of a changing of the guard, which I think it seems like from your reporting, he was fine with. He understood. He just didn't appreciate kind of being left in the dark about it and only finding out sort of seemingly at the last minute.
Yeah, or finding out in real time when breaking news is happening and all of a sudden. So he and also very interesting that he went to Bob Iger. He did not go to Peter Rice, who's the new boss of that whole division. Bob Iger's not even the boss of the company anymore. He's not the CEO. He didn't go to Bob Chapek, who's the CEO of the company. He went to what I'm told is the guy he trusts because he felt that he was not that the people who he reports to, who was James Goldstein and Peter Rice, were not straight with him and doesn't have a relationship with Bob Chapek, who just took over CEO a year ago and ran Parks before that. So first of all, I think it does lay bare a weakness in Bob Chapek's leadership of the company, because those relationships with talent are absolutely key. I think it lays bare a weakness for Peter Rice, who is a consummate political inside player, as I have reported on and written for many years. It was the case at Fox, where he was Rupert Murdoch's kind of adopted son in a way, although he has real sons, but he loved Peter and promoted him and supported him over many years. And then Peter did a very savvy pivot when Fox was acquired by Disney and built a relationship with Bob Iger and basically got to replace the person who was there before him, Ben Sherwood, and has very cannily maneuvered as there's been the Game of Thrones around CEO job that went to Bob Chapek. Ultimately, Kevin Mayer was the other person who was to get it, no longer at the company. So somebody maneuvered well and somebody did not. So, and by the way, Kevin Mayer is one of like three really top longstanding Disney executives who didn't get the CEO job and are no longer at the company. Peter's still there. He made sure to go on that plane with Bob Iger when Bob Iger flew across the country to fix it with George Stephanopoulos. So all that stuff is like super good, juicy insider stuff. And I can say that with some confidence because, oh my God, the story's been like viral for 2 days. Who knew that so many people would be interested in how and why James Goldstein left ABC News?
And it all worked out for Stephanopoulos because he got a little extra money, got a little side deal, some production stuff.
He did.
It worked out well for him.
It worked out, and he's going to have that perch. The only problem is now that everybody knows why he has those things. But anyway, we're just going to stick to our knitting over here at The Wrap. All right. On to the Golden Globes. They were Sunday night. And if the ratings are any indication, that might be news to some of you. Only 6.9 million people watched the ceremony, which was down from just over 18 million in 2020. That's about a 2/3 drop in audience. For those of you who don't know a lot about ratings, that's not a good thing. The bad showing of the show, I'm going to call it, came as the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the group behind the Globes, has faced massive criticism for having no Black members, a fact that came up several times during the show and that led to a landmark moment on the show in which three members of the HFPA stood up and committed to fixing that situation. Among the winners, The Crown took home 4 awards, Nomadland and Borat subsequent movie film took home two each. And in the emotional moment of the night, Chadwick Boseman won posthumously for his lead role in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. So, Daniel, we talked last week about longstanding corruption in the HFPA that has marred the Golden Globes. Is there anything new to be learned from this year's ceremony?
Well, I think we're all tired of Zoom, right? We're tired of this virtual thing that we're doing. And they tried to do something where there was the hosts were live in an auditorium, but they were in front of first responders and everyone else was on cameras and there were pre-taped bits. And I think it all sort of fell pretty flat. You know, we have the Oscars coming up in a couple months, and I'm going to steal something I saw on Twitter, and I do not remember who tweeted it, but I love the suggestion. What do you think of having this year's Oscars at the Hollywood Bowl? You could have it outside. You have this huge seating arena, so you could probably space out everyone. I think you could probably have a semblance of an awards show that way. I just think, you know, this is trying to...
How would you deal with the sound, you know, for it to, for telecast quality, you know?
I suppose you could. I'm sure they've recorded shows there before that they've used for other things. I just think it would be a really interesting thing. I would hate to park there because anyone not in LA knows, I'm going to break it to you now. Parking at the Hollywood Bowl is the worst thing ever. It would be a mad dash out of there to run into your limos, but... You know, we got the Emmys are still a few months away, so maybe things will be better by then. I believe it's the SAG Awards announced this week that they're going to pre-tape. Was it the SAGs?
But that's not the problem. The problem is that nobody was excited about the movies.
Yeah, and I think no one.
There's no true red carpet. I'm just saying, in terms of trying to save the ratings of the Oscars, I don't know if having it at the Hollywood Bowl is going to solve that problem.
Yeah, I'm always bewildered by people who watch things one year and don't another. I've never been that way. Like, I'm not suddenly going to skip the Super Bowl. I don't understand that.
I would say that the cratering of the Golden Globes ratings is definitely a bad augur for the Oscars.
Yeah, and as our ratings expert had pointed out, the Golden Globes rating have been very steady over time. While some have dipped a little, the Golden Globes are usually like solid as a rock where they are. So for them to drop is...
Yes, all of the elements that go into creating excitement about the movies that are going to be at the Oscars, which is to say the marketing campaigns that accompany the movies as they go out in theaters, the various events that lead up to it, whether it's, you know, the other awards, SAG or even the Golden Globes, or the various parties that get coverage in celebrity media. None of that is there this year because of COVID. And so there is such a notable lack of buzz around films. And I don't think that what was picked at the Golden Globes is, and by the way, for example, Mank, the David Fincher film about, sort of the golden era Hollywood, It got a bunch of nominations, but went home with no awards at all. I don't think any of that can necessarily be a guide for what's going to either be nominated or win at the Oscars. So, and we still have another good at least 6 weeks of this before the Oscars happen.
I know. And I'm going to just throw this out there. Bring back a host. I think the hostless ceremony is bad. I don't enjoy
it. Hugh Jackman, who are you thinking?
Hugh was pretty good. Bring Billy back would be... Neil Patrick Harris has done well when he's hosted some certain things. We've sort of lost Ellen, so she's out of it.
David Letterman? Don't think so.
Nah, he's probably not going to do it again. But I'd like to figure out something. I think that could be a way of, like, you know, bringing people in. Because they're, like you said, they're going to need to do something. The Globes were a bad harbinger of things to come. Finally this week, Andrew Cuomo apologized, but said he would not step down as governor of New York amid growing calls for him to resign over multiple sexual harassment allegations. Cuomo has gone from media darling to pariah in just a matter of weeks. Don't forget, he's also been taken to task for how the state has handled COVID-19 in nursing homes. With Cuomo making headlines for all the wrong reasons, his brother, CNN's Chris Cuomo, said this week he would not cover the allegations against his brother Andrew, but understood that CNN would continue to do so. The network didn't have a problem with Chris having Andrew on his show several times throughout the pandemic when everyone loved Andrew, but now the public opinion has shifted. Suddenly, it's a non-starter. Sarah, I'm wondering, do you think CNN made a mistake with Andrew Cuomo previously, and how do you feel they are handling this tricky situation now?
I don't think that they've handled it improperly. I think that there is no way that Chris Cuomo can have a shred of credibility in covering the story about the shitstorm that his brother's in right now. He's made it really clear on the air that he loves his brother, that blood runs super thick in his family. And I think it was fine for him to take advantage of the inside track to have the governor on CNN frequently, more frequently than other people, to have access to him. And when it was a matter of how he handled COVID, he did try to answer, to ask him some tough questions occasionally. And always, you know, you knew that the loyalty was fundamentally there. But he can't cover this. This is way too personal and way too uncomfortable and awkward. So I absolutely think that the best choice is for him to say, I'm out of this story because I can't cover it dispassionately in any way, shape, or form. And I think it was okay for him to have Andrew Cuomo on earlier in the pandemic. But I do think that it absolutely, all of that sort of show of love and loyalty on air made it impossible for him to participate in covering the story. That's my sense. How about you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm sure at the time CNN said, oh, everyone loves Andrew Cuomo. This is news. We have access. It's a great idea. But in retrospect, the general idea of should an anchor, a host, interview their brother about an issue is probably something that everyone would say, no, that's not a good idea. And I'm sure at the time they were like, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
This is the worst that could happen, because now all of a sudden you have a story that you have to cover. And now it looks really weird that you had him on your network a bunch of times. And they had some really strange segments where they were joking with each other. And now that all looks like it was, you know, something better fit for The View than CNN's primetime programming. It just seems that the 1% chance of this coming back to bite them in the ass has actually happened.
Are you suggesting then what should Chris Cuomo have done on his show? Just had somebody else invite his brother on?
Have Andrew on Anderson Cooper. Have Andrew on other shows. He could have gone on any hour. But he went with his brother. They thought it was fun and they thought it made for good TV.
TV, that's for sure. And I think that's what Jeff Zucker at CNN cares about more than anything else. But I think it would have been odd for Chris Cuomo to conspicuously not interview his brother as a conflict of interest, because most of it was informational and dealing with public health issues that are important to a large segment of CNN viewers who might be in New York. So yeah, I don't know, we can disagree about this, but
yeah, and I guess New York obviously carries more weight, but you know, the question could be asked.
Well, New York was the epicenter of the pandemic for the first 3 months. So yes.
Yeah. But I think, you know, there are plenty of other governors who probably did a great job with their state. Why did CNN pick Andrew Cuomo so many times? Like, I think you open yourself up to that in this particular situation where I think somewhere in the rule book, it probably says, don't do this. And they thought, well, this is the one time we'll do it. And they probably should have just stuck to the rule book and said, bad idea.
I think it's a lot greater than that. But I think what is clear is that he should not be not try to report on the story because he's
there's no good way to do that now for sure.
Yeah.
All right. As always, we like to conclude this last segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, which allows our founder, editor-in-chief, CEO, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something that maybe has her particularly riled up, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
My Wax On this week is, I've been railing at Governor Newsom from this perch for a number of weeks, and even months, one could say. Going to give him a little bit of a hat tip. California now has 10 million people vaccinated, according to the governor. That would be a quarter of the population. I still think that the rollout of the vaccination has been unforgivably chaotic. I still hear stories of people waiting for hours in line in stadiums and cars, but we are getting vaccines into arms. And apparently we have a whole lot of vaccines that have arrived that are about to go like next week into the arms of lots of teachers. So I think that's good. California is a whole hell of a lot safer than it was 2 months ago. Our infection rate or our COVID positive rate is 2.1%. So it's way below where it was. We were heading up toward 5% in the last few months when we're in like super red zone. So that's a good thing. And I really hope that the state and the federal government too learn the lessons of what a really, really piss poor job has been done around protecting people, informing people, and getting people vaccinated. None of that has gone particularly well. And I think that the onus on the state to have a vaccination system set up and ready to go, is like really the most unforgivable failing, because they knew a vaccine was coming for months. So the fact that there is not enough vaccine for any particular time is not on Newsom, but not having a seamless system is. So that to me, so that's my wax on, my wax off, my wax on, sorry, because we've made progress there. My wax off is the governor at the other end of the country, Andrew Cuomo. What WTF, I'm not going to say the words out loud, but seriously, enough with the dirty old man crap. We are so tired of this shit. I am definitely an advocate for the Me Too movement and women speaking their piece. But I am also an advocate for women having their big boy pants on, taking responsibility for being a young woman or an older woman out in the world, being confident enough to say no and to mean it and to impose it. But what we're seeing in the three cases of women who've come forward with Andrew Cuomo are three young women who, in two of the cases, were subordinate to him in his office. And that is a textbook case of abusing your power and dirty old man vibe. Like, keep your hands to yourself. You're 30, 40 years older than these girls. And that girl who had her friend take a picture when he had his face in his grip at the party, having just apparently inappropriately put his hand on her back, and she removed his hand as in a very clear signal of, I am not comfortable with you touching me. And then he puts his face in her hand to kiss her, is totally not okay. Just cut it out, you guys. Just cut it out. The 22-year-olds don't want to date you 63-year-olds. So Andrew Cuomo, you're an eligible bachelor. You're a good-looking guy. You can be charming when you want to be. You're capable. You're smart. I bet you are a lot of fun to go to a concert with when you want to be. Can you please troll those waters with women who are interested in you and appropriate to your age? That's my wax off.
Hear, hear. All right, that'll do it for this first segment of the show, Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, our conversation with Sacha Baron Cohen and the Borat team, and my interview with Steve Yockey, showrunner of the hit HBO Max series, The Flight Attendant. Stick around. Sacha Baron Cohen and the Borat subsequent movie film team got together this week to chat with The Wrap's Brian Welk about how the film came together, some of the incredible hurdles they had to overcome during filming, and yes, that infamous scene with Rudy Giuliani. The panel included Cohen, director Jason Walliner, writer Peter Bainum, and producers Anthony Hines and Monica Levinson. We're going to break this up into a few different segments to help you kind of keep track of who is talking. So in this first segment, you're going to hear from Sasha, and then Sasha and Monica Levinson, and then from director Jason Walliner, who talks about how he came aboard the project. Take a listen.
Sasha, I want to start with you. When did you know that you had to get the band back together, that you wanted to revive Borat and do this character again, and you know that you knew there was a story there that really made sense?
I think it was really with the Muslim ban that was introduced by Trump, and then Charlottesville. I felt I had to do something. I was talking with Ant and our other collaborator, Dan Swimer, about what we could do. We did a show called Who is America? And then we realized that Borat actually was the best way to, you know, to shine a mirror up to what was going on in America at that point, and to be, you know, be obviously funny and entertaining. It was a way for us to challenge what we were very worried about, which was this gradual slide into authoritarianism that we'd been witnessing for a couple of years. So literally, I called up everyone in the team and said, I want to do another Borat movie. They all said, you're completely crazy. And that was before COVID. So it's unbelievable that we actually managed to get this done. But that's thanks to an incredible team, amazing, amazing relentlessness and talent.
So this is then a question for all of you. I mean, was there still an appetite for from the studios for another Borat? Or was there ever a question in your mind that, you know, Borat could still exist in 2020?
I mean, I think, Sasha, you should take that. But I mean, personally, I thought that there wouldn't be, but there was shockingly a nice appetite for it. And Sasha was really involved in that.
I mean, yes, this was a complicated thing. You know, it was originally with Fox, and then it Universal and Donna Langley decided that they would make the movie. And obviously, at the time, it was a risky movie to make. Donald Trump was wreaking vengeance on corporations that he felt were disloyal to him. And this was clearly a movie that had a, you know, that was taking a side, and it was intended to be released prior to the election, 10 days before the election. So it was a risky venture, really, for any major corporation in America. And then obviously it went to Amazon when we realized that theaters would not be open, and we were left with this really difficult choice, which was, do we release this movie and have crowds of people enjoy it and wait a year and a half? And we all really believed that we were making it for one reason, which was to release it prior to the election. As our, you know, as our comment, because of our, you know, fear of what was happening. And we felt it was better for people to see it at home during the pandemic than to wait and collectively see it. Mm-hmm. And I think we're really glad that Amazon got it out there and people around the world enjoyed it.
I mean, obviously this movie was made in top secret. No one even knew until very recently that there was going to be a second Borat film, a subsequent movie film. And I want to talk, Jason, you know, when did you get involved in this? This is actually your debut film. Talk about getting involved and when did you know, oh my God, I'm making Borat 2?
Sure. I got an email at the beginning of March of 2019 asking if I was interested in meeting with Sasha about, they just said his new movie. And we had met previously about Who's America, about the possibility of me directing on it. And
he lost.
I was doing other projects. I was very stubborn. And I said, I want to watch this show, but I need to focus on my own stuff. And I love the show, but it didn't work out then. But Sasha called me back for this one, and they didn't tell me what it was. And I got an encrypted script with full of code words that doesn't say the word Borat in the entire script. And it was somewhere between a script and an outline. And we can talk about kind of the way we script this type of movie. But I read it. I read a page and kind of realized what it was. And I thought, oh, my God, he's doing Borat, too. He's doing another one, finally. And I thought it was so funny. And I went and met with Sasha and Ant and Monica and some other people 2 days later. And I was very blunt. I said, you know, I think you made the funniest movie of all time. To do a sequel that isn't a huge disappointment is going to be very difficult, especially for this movie, which you have to do, as you said, in complete secrecy. You know, already the idea of Borat having a daughter, the whole structure of the movie as it was released was essentially figured out at that point, too. The journey with the daughter was what they had from the beginning. And, you know, I said, it's going to be nearly impossible to find the right actress for this role who can do that with you, who can do these scenes with real people, who can convincingly be a teenager, who can be as funny and brave as you are. And, you know, on top of that, there was this idea of making a real political statement before the election and, you know, getting it out in time. it was a much, even before COVID, it was a much tighter window than Sasha and Monica and Ant had on the previous movies. And at the same time, you know, the whole father-daughter story was very ambitious to do in a movie like this, where it's difficult to have an emotional movie that works, that moves the viewer, that gets you invested in the story while doing all these satirical scenes with real people. It's kind of two different parts of a viewer's brain. So, you know, I said this is a nearly impossible project. It's probably a huge mistake, but if we pull it off, it could be really incredible. It could be really special. And Sasha, of course, knew everything I was saying, knew how daunting it was, and agreed with me. And I think we were both excited by how daunting it seemed. Just the kind of sliver of a chance we had of success made it very exciting.
In this next part, you'll hear from producer Anthony Hines, Sasha, and then director Peter Walliner about the process of finding Maria Bakalova, who plays Borat's daughter.
Talk about finding her, and when did you know, yeah, she can do this, she can handle everything we're going to throw at her in this movie?
Who wants to talk about that one?
The casting process to find Tutar was probably one of the most broad, intensive casting exercises. I think 600 actresses we looked at, and we went through America, we went through Europe, and then we just kept spreading out further, and we were getting actresses in the Balkans and Eastern Europe basically to self-tape. And it was just a process of literally finding time to sit through hundreds of self-tape auditions. And Maria just sprung from this. It was a needle in a haystack, but it was immediately very exciting. But even at that stage, there were many unknowns. And it's one thing self-taping yourself in your flat in Burgas, Bulgaria, but then for that same person to end up in that bedroom with Rudy Giuliani is quite a journey. And so we knew immediately she had potential, but how great she would turn out to be, it was always going to be a slight chance.
But we knew that she, was one of a kind. We felt we couldn't actually make the movie until we had found Borat's daughter. Maria Bakalova is a complete revelation. She's absolutely hilarious. She's amazingly courageous, having to film scenes with real people, some of them quite dangerous, staying in character for many, many hours. She has to completely embody the character. And she's just an incredible actor. In the audition, one of the auditions, we had five auditions with her, including with real people and having to stay in character. We did the breakup scene. For those people out there who've seen the movie, she realizes that the book she's been brought up on is full of lies, and the real book that's full of truth is Facebook. And it's from that she found out that the Holocaust never happened. And so she rejects her dad. She did this scene with me, and it was so emotional. I found myself about to cry. And obviously, being English, I didn't want that to happen. So I was like, all right, that's enough. We had a quick powwow. We're like, okay, you've got the part. But she is a revelation and a one-off, and it is the bravest performance of the year.
I think she's a kind of a miracle, because like it's to be real and believable, but also comic and very funny, and to be able to carry those both things, to be convincing. So to be funny, because I think there were people you'd seen, hadn't there, that were funny, but the moment you test them with real people will go, hang on, there's something going on here. And it feels to me like there's virtually nobody in the world that can do this, the level that Sasha does that at, and she turned out to be the other one. So it's great.
We had one part of the audition process would be that she would sit down with a real person and interview them, and the moment that she said her first joke, with all the other actors, they would say, hold on, this is a comedy bit, you're an actor. And so she was, what you've got to do is you've got to make sure that the whole performance is on the same level so that the jokes aren't jumping out. And she's, she did that brilliantly. But all the other actors we had, and there were some brilliant and well-known people that we had who auditioned, they could not handle that.
For this third segment, you'll hear from director Jason Walliner, Sasha, Peter Bainham, Monica Levinson, and then Sasha again, as they talk about what it was like to shoot the film as the pandemic began to really take over the country.
I want to go back because you mentioned the conspiracy theorists, and obviously the Wuhan flu song was written in COVID, but you know, at what point, like, I assume there was a conspiracy element that was in the script before COVID started. So talk about, you know, writing that song on the fly, adjusting to COVID and knowing how the story was going to work in that context. Maybe Jason, if you want to start.
Sure. Something that was fortunate is that, you know, we already had structured in Borat and Tutar separating at a certain point in the movie. We studied a lot of romantic comedies and what they call two-handers. It Happened One Night, for example. And, you know, we knew that they would have this break and she would reject him and then he would be looking for her. And so that was in from fairly early on. And we had talked about ideas. Maybe he enlisted the help of like men's rights activists and they tried to track her down and found her at originally it was going to be a gun rally. And then we were trying to shoot in order as much as possible because things would change. And we also wanted to kind of track the characters and track the emotional story of the movie. So when we shut down, we were kind of around that point in the movie and, you know, saw these anti-mask, anti-lockdown rallies happening and just kind of figuring out once we realized, you know, we were determined to finish the movie. If it was possible at all, we wanted to finish it and get it out on that release date a week and a half before the election. And once, you know, the industry started figuring out some protocols of a level of minimizing risk and being able to try to shoot again during COVID, we were out again, you know, a few weeks after those protocols were established. And we were working with amazing epidemiologists, Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo at Johns Hopkins. And we had a whole team to kind of figure out how to safely shoot during COVID. And at the same time, you know, we said in the writing period while we were shut down, said, well, if it's not men's rights, guys, what if he hooks up with some of these kind of anti-lockdown, pro-Trump, anti-mask conspiracy guys? And that inspired us to find what became Jim and Jerry. And instead of a gun rally, you know, that was a gun rally, the March for Our Rights, it was called. But it became a gun rally slash anti-lockdown rally. So we were fortunate in that we kind of were able to take beats that we knew we already wanted to get in the movie and shape them to kind of what the world had become. We realized very early on you couldn't make a movie that was in many ways a documentary about 2020 without addressing what happened to the world and how much of a difference in all of our lives COVID has made.
I think also we realized that COVID was a way of showing how lies and conspiracies can actually kill people, and the conspiracies spread by the Trump government were actually leading to the unnecessary death of hundreds of thousands of Americans. And we had this epiphany, myself and Jason. We had shot at CPAC. We had incredible momentum for the movie. We're like, okay, we're going to be able to make this movie and get it done. We shut down because of COVID. We kept the edit going. And then one day, one of the editors showed myself and Jason a clip from CPAC, one of the dailies. And it was the vice president at the time, Mike Pence, giving this speech saying, we only have 15 cases. And as the president said to me today, whatever it is, we are ready. And we suddenly had this epiphany. We realized that this was also a movie about COVID. And the backdrop of the second half of the movie would be coronavirus. And if this was a movie about the wrongdoings of the Trump regime, arguably the greatest wrongdoing was the willful negligence when it came to coronavirus and the safety of the American public. So we felt if we didn't risk our own safety by highlighting that, what was the purpose of making this movie? We restructured, we kept the same themes and the same overall shape of the movie, but we made this our act three backdrop.
I think this speaks to also that how much writing and planning and thinking goes into a movie like this. There's just so much because stuff gets reshaped and changed, and it's got all the beats and the relationship beats and the developments and the comic scenes of any movie, but also somebody might turn around and go, Rudy Giuliani isn't going to do it. Or, well, he did it, thankfully. But all the time, things are planned, things are scripted right up to the last minute, and then stuff gets pulled. And so it's like, that's an extra challenge to all this. It's just, it's a crazy process.
Do you want to talk about the Wuhan flu and why I'm there?
I was just going to say that it was written literally. I mean, the idea sort of came because of this fluid process. It came a week before. And they had to, you know, not only come up with lyrics, but also then add to the lyrics in the house, have that be part of the lockdown house and have Jim and Jerry add to the sequence, keep writing it, keep working on it, and then literally changing it up to the minute as Sasha's about to go in, you know, Country Steve is about to go onto stage. So it's such a process where Aaron is working, you know, to change. He got this catchy tune that he knew would work, but, you know, it was everybody tweaking, you know, Sasha and Ant, especially, you know, giving notes, going back and forth. And then, you know, it's like all of the writers were working 24/7 to get that right.
I was going to say, Monica, in terms of, you know, once you had the shutdown or once, you know, production, yeah, once COVID, the reality set in of what the industry was going to, what was going through your mind in terms of how are we going to finish this and how do we do it safely?
Right. Well, I think, you know, we had conversations daily and, you know, the estimates that Sasha was on the cusp of it, talking to people from day one and getting pretty bad estimates of where we were going to be. And he certainly had more of, you know, he had information. He was like, listen, this is not going to be good. We're not going to be able to keep going. And I kept thinking, oh, it's going to be a few weeks. You know, we were all sort of denying that this was going to shut us down completely. And then at a certain point, you know, we just spoke every single day. And it was like, when can we go? When can we go? And knowing that the election, you know, we had to go before the election, we just, at a certain point, we said, we have to start. I think it was like May 15th, I called everybody and I said, if we don't start June 15th, we're not going to finish. So we have to start June 15th and we will figure out these protocols and we will make sure that everybody is safe. And so, you know, like Jason said, we worked with an amazing group of people that advised us. And actually we were slightly ahead of the industry. We were the first people out. And so we had to be stricter in our protocols to make sure that we were protecting everybody. And at the time, you know, in June, you knew a lot less than you know now. So we made sure that everybody was safe. And we went out with a really cool testing machine that was brand new. And we were able to do quick tests on people. We were doing, you know, 5 tests a week. Sasha was, I'm sure his nose was not comfortable, but he was being tested almost every day. So yeah, it was nerve-wracking, but we also all knew that we had this common goal and we wanted to make it work. So the way to make it work was to go out safely and get it done.
How does that work when you're in quarantine, when you're in lockdown with Jim and Jerry, with two guys, you know, that you don't know and that, you have no idea what's going to happen?
Well, in terms of COVID, we tested everyone before they came on camera. Obviously, you can't do that at a gun rights rally. And actually, at that rally, we were told that if people felt you were infiltrating or not legitimately there, that they would get COVID-positive people to spit at you. But there were other challenges with Jim and Jerry in that it was the first time in my career that I'd had to spend more than a day in character. And it was actually 5 days in character, and that was probably the hardest thing I've had to do in the movie, probably the hardest thing I've had to do in my career, which is try and do a scene that lasts 5 days. You've got to fully inhabit the character and make sure that any question that's asked of you, anything you do in that 5 days, from how you eat, how you, you know, exercise, how you go to the bathroom, how you go to sleep at night, how you get drunk with them, anything can be a tell where at any point they could go, hold on, you've just contradicted yourself. That didn't make sense. You're not real. And then the scene is gone. And we didn't have time once COVID hit to reshoot scenes. So we had to get it right. And it was I remember with Jim and Jerry about 5 hours before going into the lockdown house, we found out that they knew about Kazakhstan, and we made the decision to change Borat's nationality to be from Belarus. And then for the remaining hours, I just ingested everything I could about Belarus, the culture, history, government, locations. But it was like a quick digest so I could answer anything that they would throw at me for the next 5 days. But it was immensely, I was trying to act very relaxed, but anyone who watches that, you should know that I was terrified during those 5 days.
Finally, this last part is just Sasha talking about filming that infamous scene with Rudy Giuliani and if we will ever see Borat again.
I got to ask about Rudy. Was it always Rudy? Was that always the goal that you were going to get him? Or, and what happened if you didn't get Rudy?
Go on, Sasha.
Well, we made this movie to infiltrate Trump's inner circle. You know, we felt that was the one thing that we could do, possibly, that other actors could not necessarily, or comedians could not necessarily do. That was why we came up with the idea of Borat's daughter. And if we were highlighting the misogyny that was at the epicenter of this regime, what better way than to have somebody from Trump's inner circle be completely inappropriate with a young girl in a hotel room? So, you know, as a result, Maria was, you know, inside Trump's inner circle. She was in a small room listening to Trump speak in Las Vegas. She was introduced to one of his sons. She was brought in, even after the movie finished, to the White House by the Washington correspondent of OAN, One American News, and almost brought into a press conference with Trump speaking. She was actually stopped by one of the other, you know, mainstream media news sites who said, hold on, that girl doesn't have credentials. But it was crucial to have some. We had a couple of people that we were thinking we have to have this movie with. And yes, on the day, Rudy turns up and he refuses to have a COVID test. And we were, again, we gave our word, Monica and I and Anne, to the rest of the crew. We're like, we're going to keep ourselves safe and you guys need to be safe as well. So we're bringing all these nurses and doctors with us. We're bringing PPE. We're doing the testing and we're giving you our word that you're going to be as safe as we are. And so we had a very strict rule. No one gets, you know, in a closed room indoors with us if they've not been COVID tested. Rudy turns up. He's refusing to get a test. This was prior to him actually contracting COVID. And then we had a sit down with Maria and we said, listen, this is going to be a risk. He, you know, we can't guarantee you that he doesn't have COVID. And Maria felt very strongly that she had to do the scene. You know, this was the, you know, this scene structurally. And again, we tried to ingest all of the father-daughter movies, all of these kind of arranged marriage movies, all these, you know, what's it, romances like It Happened One Night. But it's that move, the scene off, you're trying to stop the wedding from happening, the ring from going on the finger. It's almost like a thriller as well of Rudy, structurally as a screenwriter, is almost like a killer and the murder weapon is down his trousers. So Borat has to get in there and stop the fatal blow. No pun intended. So without Rudy, you know, we had run out of time. You know, if that scene hadn't have worked, the movie would certainly not have been as impactful. And at the time we had no... We realized that he was obviously Trump's lawyer. He was in the inner circle. We had no concept of how crucial he would be in the Republicans' attempt to undermine the Biden campaign, or the timing of that, because our movie got released actually on the same day as the final presidential debate when Rudy was on his way to deliver this bogus hard drive about the, you know, supposed stuff that he'd found. And we had no idea also of how instrumental Rudy would be to spreading Trump's big lie of a stolen election post November 3rd, and how instrumental he would be in the Capitol riots as well. So we were lucky. as well.
But I also have to say that, you know, with these movies, there's no settling for second best. You know, we're constantly pursuing for, you know, pursuing the best option. And as the practical one, I was always saying, we need a plan B. We just need a plan B for this last piece. And honestly, there was never a plan B. It was always, let's keep going for who we need. That's what's going to be part of the movie. And the field team, you know, working constantly to make sure that we got Rudy or, you know, one of these people in the inner circle. But it's true, we didn't have a backup, and it was only because they refused. Everybody refused to settle for something that wasn't going to be good enough.
I mean, there was a table read for this movie very, you know, way back when people loved it, I think, and trusted people who came in, and a lot of people that know Sasha and are very, very smart people. And they all said, great movie, utterly impossible. You know, this is, and it's funny to look back and think it probably was impossible, but somehow it got made, you know.
Well, I have time for one more question before I throw it over to the audience. I got to ask, Sasha, you effectively retired the Borat character because he was just so recognizable. Is there any possibility, any future in which, you know, Borat could see the light of day again?
No. I think we were all, you know, again, you know, the crew and, you know, the people you see before you took really immense risks to make this movie. I mean, it felt more impossible than Fitzcarraldo. It really, I can never do it again, and I could never ask them to do it again. No, I think we were very lucky. We took an immense amount of care planning it all, but no, Borat is in the wardrobe, locked up, never to be seen again.
Our guest this week is the showrunner and executive producer of the super popular HBO Max series, The Flight Attendant, which was nominated for 2 Golden Globes and is certain to be a contender all throughout award season. Please welcome to the podcast, Steve Yockey. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
So we're recording this on Wednesday. Golden Globes were on Sunday. I was hoping that we would be celebrating together. It's not quite how it turned out. Can I ask you, is it weird to lose a Golden Globe, like, just in your, from the comfort of your own home?
No, I mean, that probably made it easier, but it was the comfort of my own home. But I also think, like, as cheesy and Hallmark-esque as this sounds, for us, we honestly never expected the show to hit like it has. And so just like being nominated meant a lot. So we were very excited. I had a lot of fun watching Sunday. I thought it was a technical miracle that we made it to the end of that telecast.
Do you have a certain hatred now for Schitt's Creek? Because they kind of got you in both those categories.
No, because we were watching. It's really hard.
It's hard to hate Catherine O'Hara, right?
You can't hate Catherine O'Hara. And I know that Kaylee worships her.
Oh, yeah. So
we were all watching Schitt's Creek on the set, like while we were filming our show. So there's really no ill will.
You mentioned the popularity. I do feel like this was sort of the show for the last couple of months of 2020. Do you have a moment when you realize you're like, oh, people are really liking this. People are really into this.
I think it was really odd because I think I don't usually read reviews, but people were kind of forwarding me reviews. Like, you need to be reading this, what people are saying about the show. And because it was so positive. And then there started to be, I will say the quarantine, the pandemic made it weird because you of course you're hearing from people that you know, because those, like, you're literally seeing the same 3 people on any given day. And they're all like, yeah, we like the show a lot. So it sort of started to seep in how popular the show actually was. But I think when HBO Max told us on a call that, like, they sort of gave us some raw data about the people watching the show, and I was shocked. I think it was slow dawning for us exactly how popular it was. But I also think we kind of timed out with the release for streaming because, you know, we were sort of reaching a point where everyone had gotten to the end of Netflix and was nearing the end of Hulu, you know, with only like the kind of like really difficult to watch stuff left. And so we kind of popped in with something bright and shiny that was still a little bit grounded and you could have an emotional ride. So I think it timed out pretty well for the show that we managed to reach a lot of people.
One of the things we talk about with streaming, I'm curious what your opinion is, HBO Max sort of does the sort of like a modified weekly format, right? I think they released one and then I think they did two, 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 and then the finale.
Ours was three, two, two, one.
Three, two, yeah, I forget. They're all a little different. Do you have a preference with how that goes? Because some people like getting it all out there at once. Some people like the weekly format. As the creator, do you have any feeling?
I'm having the experience now. I'm having the experience now with WandaVision of like the weekly release now, where I'm like, give me the next one. But it really does drive my like need for appointment television, which I haven't had in a long time. But for us, I thought the 3-2-2-1 model worked really well because watching two episodes of something feels like the beginning of a binge, but then, you know, you kind of are still hungry for the next. So we always knew that they were going to drop the first three episodes together. So we planned for that and we wrote towards the end of the third episode to give it a big like,
okay,
dun, dun, dun. But, but then I felt like the 2-2-1 actually really paid off for us in terms of keeping people interested and invested.
You mentioned, we were talking a little bit before about COVID. You have a, you know, you guys are starting up. I think how far into season two stuff are you, still just writing or where are you?
Today
at
was
there?
Day two of the writer's room.
Day two of the writer's room. So you guys were very affected by COVID in season one. You had to like sort of break, I think, after episode six or something, and you had a long delay.
One day in episode six.
Yeah. Are you, when you're starting to plan for season two, how does COVID sort of play into that?
I think, well, listen, we're all hoping for, by the time we're filming, we're hoping for a little bit of a, that the world will look a little bit different, but certainly we'll take into consideration the number of crowd scenes. I mean, the trickiest things are like, the scenes on the airplane where you have extras in close quarters and you can't really get around it. So that's the kind of stuff we're going to have to keep our eye on. But right now we're sort of just at the beginning of the breaking story part of it. So that'll kind of come into play when we get into script.
Do you think you'll find yourself opting against certain types of scenes? Like you mentioned, I mean, you can't get around a crowded plane, and a plane is obviously pretty important to a show called The Flight Attendant, but do you think you'll find yourself going, maybe I'll find a different way to do this that's a little easier to shoot?
I think that there's some things that we're going to want to do that we're going to have to think twice about, like having a scene that takes place in a major airport isn't probably going to be as available to us. And that was not easy, but it was easy to get the access. It wasn't always easy to load all the equipment through security and get all the people in that we needed. But so there are things like that. And quite frankly, there are some stunts that we might not maybe go down that road. There were some stunts in season one that we sort of had to pare back or change a little bit because the safety requirements just didn't add up to the time that it would take to get the things done.
I want to ask you a couple of specific questions about the show.
Sure.
I thought you threaded a needle that very few shows do, which is, especially given that this was kind of supposed to be a limited series in the beginning, you did a really good job of ending season one, but also setting up season two. But also, if there wasn't a season two, I'd be okay. How did you sort of pull that off? Because I do believe that you didn't know if there'd be a season two when you were writing season one. So explain to me how you juggled all those balls, because I think you nailed it perfectly. I
really appreciate it. Like for me as a playwright coming into television, like it's, you want things to have a beginning, middle, and an end. Like you want people to get to the end of that eight episodes, whether there's going to be a season two or not. You want people to feel dramatically satisfied, like, oh, that, like to hit that spot in people's brains. And then if there are little things left hanging that can kind of tease a potential second season, that's what you aim for. So for us, we very much sat down and said, like, cool, let's treat this like just like what it is. It's an adaptation of a book. And if there's a second season, it's going to be another book, like another Cassie Bowden flight attendant adventure. So we're going to tell a complete mystery story, a complete emotional story, and then we're just going to have a few things at the end that kind of leave people wanting more in a fun way. We hoped that people weren't going to be like, tell me what happened to Megan now or I will murder everyone. Like, you know, it's like, and we sort of had to fight for that ending too, because it's like, you know, there were factions sort of that wanted everyone to have a happy ending. And life doesn't work like that. And certainly Megan's story doesn't work like that. So, but we'll get to find out what's going on with Megan.
Yeah, I don't want to, I feel like I want to ask you one or two season two-ish questions that I'm sure you can't answer.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'll do it. I'll try anyway. I read a lot of interviews where people asked you about whether or not you ever thought about tying Megan's story into Cassie's story, like have them be the same thing. Mm-hmm. But you didn't. And to me, I took it at the end was Megan's story is going to be the impetus for season two. Because there's this whole mystery that's like kind of been in the background the whole time, but now maybe that comes to the forefront.
Well,
does that sound like something that might
happen? I mean, it sounds like something. We always envisioned Megan. The way we thought about it in the writer's room was because this is very much how it is in Chris's book. It's just harder to see it this way in a book. But Megan's sort of like starring in her own little movie. She's the star of her own little movie inside the flight attendant television series that's about Cassie Bowden. So we always knew that the storylines for those two women were going to kiss in that emotional scene in episode 8, where they kind of confess everything to each other and it sends them off in their separate directions. So, yeah, I mean, I can say that we will catch up with Megan in season 2 and see what she's up to. But again, you know, I feel like I'm shielded by the fact that we're only on the second day of the writer's room. So anything can happen.
Right. And I have to assume, I feel like going back to Alex Sokolov was one of the characters in season 1, makes no sense in season 2, but because people liked that dynamic so much, you got to feel tempted to do it. I don't know where you're at in that process either, but how do you feel about sort of bringing season 1 elements into season 2 if they don't really fit?
I mean, if they don't fit, we won't do it. I can tell you with certainty that just like I said, treating each season like a separate adventure or novel for Cassie is sort of means that we're done with the Alex Sokolov story. I think that came to a really lovely end when she was walking through the Mayan Palace, the hotel suite in her mind, right, at the end of episode 8, and the rooms were shutting down behind her. I think that, you know, Cassie's moved on from that and it will look different. But, you know, there are things that the show did, like playing inside Cassie's head, the way that we played with flashbacks, some of the stylistic choices we made that obviously are part of what the show is. So they may look a little different, but they'll be present in season 2.
Yeah, I think you feel like you and the show feels very confident in the story that it wants to tell. And I don't see you as being the type to sort of cave in and be like, oh, we're going to play the same old hits again, because that's just not where the story is going to go. I don't think that's how it seems to me, at least.
I mean, yeah, I hope that we can continue to I hope we can continue to surprise and delight people for another 8 episodes when we finally get to make those 8 episodes. But I don't think anyone on our staff or any of our producers or our star are interested in like retreading. So you can expect from a season 2 that Cassie's emotional story will continue moving forward from where she was at the end of season 1. And that there will be a new sort of Hitchcock-inspired adventure for her to Jimmy Stewart her way into and then have to find her way out of.
Normally when I'm drawn to a show, writing is first. I'm a Mamet, Sorkin, I love dialogue writing type of guy. When I'm ranking the different things that I like about a show, I can't remember ever putting music and editing so high up for me in a show as I did with this show. The way it just created this entire atmosphere, the way you did sort of jump in and out of Cassie's mind, and it, to me, that above all else is what gave the show its sort of unique feel. When you're writing it, how did you envision that, and how did that all come together?
Well, I think all of the split screens that we used for the different every phone call in the entire series is a split screen. That's just an in-house rule. So nobody ever gets to have like a mysterious one-sided phone conversation to move the plot. And then, which, you know, came back around, like by the time we got to episode 8, everybody was like, we're going to kill you, Steve. And I'm like, I don't care. We're not going to break the rule in episode 8 or whatever. But and all of the Mind Palace transitions are written into like where we go in, where we come out, where we toggle back and forth. But I have to say, our post team was really fantastic. Our editors worked in conjunction. We had 3 different editors. They were like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 that worked together to come up with the with Fuse FX that also did the Mind Palace transition for us, the look of that. We went through a couple different things until we found what was just right. We also found the tiling, the kind of throwback tiling, 60s throwback stuff we found in post. So really our editors and our music supervisor did a lot of heavy lifting in post to find just the right things.
Yeah, and I think you hit all those notes perfectly. I mean, it just, I struggle to think of a show where those elements stood out so much to me in creating the mood, just as much as the dialogue and everything else.
I think one of the things that I'm most happy about when, like, I see the episodes is we had Blake Neely as the composer for the score. And we sat down very early in the process, and I was like, I really want like a kind of Bernard Herrmann Hitchcock score, but I also want it to be a little quirky. And he was like, okay. And I was like, also, you're only allowed to use percussion instruments. And he kind of looked at me for a minute, and then he was like, you know, challenge accepted. And I didn't even know if that was gonna work, but it's what felt right to me. And what Blake came back to us with is fantastic. I think the score gives the show so much identity. And he does a really good job of telling us with music how Cassie is feeling instead of telling us how to feel about Cassie. So it really creates the sense of like palpable anxiety and tension as you're watching the show. And I think in a very effective way.
I want to ask you one last thing. You mentioned, obviously, you've written a ton of plays, live theater, not really a thing these days. And that almost above all else feels like one of the last things I think will come back.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, I'm sure you probably want to scratch that itch again and do more theater stuff, but how do you feel about that? When do you think you can even do such a thing?
I mean, you know, I'll leave that up to the individual theaters. I'll tell you that I'm still writing plays with the idea that, you know, they're going to be produced. I have a play that's actually in rehearsals right now here in Los Angeles, and they're going to do sort of a hybrid version. The Road Theater is doing it. They're going to do sort of a hybrid. There will be some people there for a live performance spaced out in a way that makes sense, but also it's going to be broadcast or streamed. So I think theaters are finding a way to kind of fill the gap between now and when they can have full audiences again. But I think you're right, though. Like, it's going to have to be a point where the kind of, even when it's safe to be in groups again, I think people are going to be hesitant to be in groups again. So it's going to be when the kind of need to revisit live performance is stronger than the fear of people getting together again.
And yeah, I think it's just tough to sit in a packed theater and laugh or, you know, sing along if it's a musical or a live concert. That seems like the last thing that'll come. All right, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. I have a feeling, I know today we did not get to celebrate any award wins, but I think there's going to be some. The show is fantastic. Congratulations. And
thanks so much.
Good luck to you the rest of award season.
I really appreciate it. We'll do our best.
Thank you much.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us. Let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.